I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever time you're listening. I'm Christopher Hooton, as I am most days of my human life. I'm culture editor at The Independent, and this is episode 3 of Kernels. It's been a couple of weeks since I last spoke to you now. The majority of which has been kind of taken up with the Oscars and my woeful predictions, most of which were all wrong. I kind of thought La La Land was going to sweep the board, and ultimately it missed out on a lot of the technical awards we thought it would, sound editing and sound mixing. But, I mean, no one's going to remember any of that anyway, because the whole night was overshadowed by the snafu, the gaffe, the mix-up, whatever word you generally don't use in everyday life that people seem to bring up when these sorts of things happen, whatever you want to refer it to as. So I was working through the night on it with my team. We were kind of remarking on how it had been kind of a boring night, even though we expected it to be, you know, one of the biggest Oscars in history with Trump hanging heavy over it. And we're like, oh, not a lot has really happened. Yeah, Kimmel's live tweeted Trump. And then suddenly this screw up, which was just unreal. Like, of all the categories it could have happened on, of all the years it could have happened in, it happened to happen on Best Picture and on this award that had become such a big kind of tussle between La La Land, the kind of filmmakers, critics film, and Moonlight, this film just so adored by the public and adored for kind of what it represents and the topics it's about. And yeah, initially everyone was just stunned, then they were angry for a little while, and then everyone just kind of, I think, well, not everyone, but I think some people managed to see the kind of the poetry in it. Barry Jenkins, I think the director of Moonlight, I think he ultimately described it as messy but kind of gorgeous, in the way that the La La Land producers kind of having this slow realization of what had happened and then passing over the award to their peers was this kind of nice moment, you know. Like, people, I don't think anyone assumes that there's antagonism between the people who are nominated and that there's this fierce rivalry or anything. But at the same time, you forget that these guys are all on the same award tour with each other. A lot of them probably worked together before, and they see each other all the time, and there's not this division at all, and that actually it's like, oh yeah, these guys won, I'm really pleased for them, we probably had coffee or a beer last night, you know. Even though the Academy was mortified, I think ultimately it kind of worked in their favor. It was quite a nice event, and I'm sure it did them a big favor in terms of ratings. So yeah, Oscars took up most of my week last week. This week, my most noticeable film moment was I went to see an advanced screening of Song to Song, which is Terrence Malick's new film with enviable cast of Ryan Gosling, Rooney Mara, Michael Fassbender, and Natalie Portman. It premiered at South by Southwest over the weekend, and he's a polarizing director, to say the least. A lot of people will kind of count out his films, at least recently, is cinematic wankery. You won't have seen Knight of Cups. It didn't get much of a release, at least in the UK. You might remember him from Tree of Life, which is that one where it's Brad Pitt in having like a 1950s domestic drama interspersed with long shots of the universe, which just didn't, even though it's sometimes heralded as like one of the best films of the decade, just didn't work for me at all. I actually found the extended shots of the universe the most compelling part about it, and the kind of dreary family drama didn't do it so much. So I don't know, Malick's been, he's had a weird few films in recent years. I went in with kind of low expectations and then was just slowly just completely won over by it. It's his usual style of this kind of collage of moments, and the way he uses the camera and the way he presents conversations between people, and it is out there, very out there. Lots of It's a familiar topic. He's not breaking new ground there. It's about relationships and about people being shitty to each other and cheating on each other and then ultimately getting drawn back into each other's orbits and not really able to end these relationships, and which, you know, we've seen time and time again in film, but he does it in a really different way. And that style he has, so that the camera's kind of following around the actors almost kind of voyeuristically, darting over their shoulder, and they're just kind of, they're interacting, but often they're not even talking, they're almost just like dancing around each other and being very tactile. And it worked this time. The style actually suited the film. And by the end of it, I was pretty much shaking coming out the screening, which is a feeling I've not had for a very long time, in the same way as you might a film like Magnolia or something. You know, usually I'll come out of a cinema, I'll stick in my headphones and I'll be able to immediately, you know, tune into something else, even if I've really enjoyed the film. But this, you know, it felt wrong to. I had to just kind of compute it for a while as I walked to the tube station. So it was I want to see it again. I want to put myself through it again. It was a brutal experience. It runs the full range of emotions, but it's going to be interesting to see what the response is like. I'm sure there'll be people that absolutely hate it and just dismiss it as just avant-garde nonsense, but I think there'll be also a fair share of people that could really see the value in it. So yeah, there's no release date for that film yet. Hopefully it'll get more of a release than Knight of Cups, but I'm sure we'll keep you posted on indie film as and when. So the guest on the podcast this week is Bob Odenkirk. I caught up with him in Berlin, of all places. He's been busy down in Albuquerque shooting Better Call Saul recently, and he's a lovely man. You kind of forget, having, you know, most of us just know him from Breaking Bad, you forget that he spent the vast majority of his career as a comedian, as a stand-up comedian, and that's given him a really kind of unique route into doing film and into doing dramatic roles, which is something we talk about a lot. And he's just a very humble guy. After the thing, he seemed very, very conscious, very self-conscious, very nervous, kind of like, was that okay? Did I do all right? So yeah, it was a pleasure to talk to him, and I hope you enjoy our chat. How's Berlin treating you? Have you managed to get out much?
Yeah, last night we got out. My son is with me, Nathan, and we got to a little tour by the van driver who they lent to us for the evening, and he took us to the site of Hitler's bunker.
Right. I haven't done that tour.
Well, it's not really much of a tour. There's just a parking lot
there. Yeah.
But there's a plaque up, and then he took us to this neighborhood, this very cool neighborhood where, anyway, a restaurant recommended by a friend of mine. I have a friend who lives here.
Cool.
Yeah.
I tried to, I went for some curry vest again last night, but I still can't get into that.
You can't? We're going to try it.
It's in theory, sausage covered in sauce sounds great,
right?
But every time
sounds
I do
awesome.
It, I'm like, this is not good.
It's not good.
No.
Why, the sauce or the sausage or both?
I think it's probably more that you hate yourself afterwards. I think it's
the overwhelming
nature of it.
Yeah.
I actually I watched Girlfriend's Day in my hotel room.
Oh, did you like it?
I did. Yeah.
All right.
I don't know what they shot it on, but it looks amazing.
Yes.
It looked
beautiful. Well, it's digital. Yeah. Well, Rich Wong, the DP, is a guy named Rich Wong, young guy, who did a great job. And Michael Stevenson, who directed it, the two of those guys came up with that look.
Yeah.
And it just feels like a classic film, which was what we wanted it to feel like, without being a parody, but nearly a parody.
Yeah. You had that like, noir thing going,
yes,
on, didn't
you? Yeah.
Is that an idea you had kicking around for
a while? That script has been on my desk for 13 years.
Yeah.
Just sitting there. And every once in a while, I'd pick it up, do a little rewrite, punch it up, write a little scene, come up with some little notion for it. It just always made me happy. And and so, you know, Netflix is a perfect place for, it's not even a real feature length. It's 65 minutes. It couldn't play in theaters. There'd be no place for it.
Yeah.
And so Netflix is a place where you can do a project that is very off beat like that, but I think satisfying. I think fun to watch.
Yeah.
And
I was going to say, because I'm making a film myself at the moment that's, I think, going to come out about 70 minutes.
Yeah,
so I was really heartened to see that you've done that at 70 minutes, and that's okay. It doesn't matter that it's not short length or feature length.
It felt like a movie, right?
Yeah,
it didn't feel like you needed another 15 minutes on it, right?
Yeah,
just make it as long as it needs to be. And now with the platforms that we have, like Netflix, now There's a place for that film.
Yeah, you just, however long the story takes is how
just
long
do
it
that.
Be.
Yeah,
I like that.
Now a lot of films, and you see this, the noir films that we were sort of in working within in Girlfriend's Day, many of them were 65 minutes long because they were built for a double feature in the 40s.
Yeah.
So a lot of those films were 65 to 70 minutes long. So we were actually sort of even in that time capacity, we were working in the realm of noir film. But, you know, also if you watch some movies, there will be an interlude in the middle that kind of feels like a time waster. I don't know how you feel, but, you know, Butch Sundance,
Butch
you know?
Cassidy, yeah.
Yeah, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. There's that sequence where they're riding the bike around. Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head plays for like 5 fucking minutes. Who gives a shit?
Yeah.
I mean, what the fuck?
It's nice to be able to experiment with length, though, because when you watch a film, you get so into this mindset of it's going to be somewhere between like 90 minutes and 20 minutes, and you see, think, oh, so I've got this act to go left, so if it cuts off a bit short or something, it's kind of...
surprising. Nice.
Yeah.
Keeps you on your feet. Yeah, keeps you on your toes.
I was at the panel yesterday, and you were talking about actors being able to move from comedy to drama, but not necessarily from drama to comedy. I have a theory on that comedy is often underpinned by sadness and a kind of a tragedy. There's often a self-deprecating nature where it comes from a place of, you can feel the sadness underneath a lot of comedy. So I guess it makes sense in a way to
bring
it out into a dramatic role. Whereas going in the other direction is there's not that scope.
Well, my observation, having been a writer at Saturday Night Live, where we would often get dramatic actors, some of whom would be very funny, like John Malkovich was such a great host, but some who just laid there, is that I think that dramatic actors sometimes think comedy is just about being loud and sort of inappropriate. And they don't realize that it's not so much that there's subtlety in comedy, but there can be, but that it's about enjoying that modulation and knowing when to be broad and when to turn a corner and, you know, subtle it up, as it were. But, you know, I just think they think that to be funny is to just turn everything up to 11, you know, and it's not really true. It's not really true. It's more knowing how to skip around on the modulation scale and have fun with it.
Yeah, it's having the confidence to deliver something a little bit more straight than going.
It's a tough call, but I do think that in every year, comic actors, either in a feature film or in a TV series, do some dramatic turn, and everyone is very surprised. And I remember Martin Short on Damages did such a great job, and it just seems to happen every year somewhere.
Yeah.
And I just think that. I agree with you that there's maybe some sadness that they're connected to in comedy that you didn't see because they don't play it overtly. And then in drama, you are allowed to show sort of the deeper level of the character. It's okay to just revel in that or immerse yourself in that. And they're able to do it.
Yeah.
And then everyone's very shocked.
Yeah. I guess like Marc Maron and Louis C.K. are good examples of that. Like with their shows, they've...
Way less
emphasis on the humor and more just the tragedy of the situation.
Well, I think, too, there's just honesty. I mean, Louis is so honest in his comedy. And so when it comes to playing a dramatic moment, well, he's going to want to play it honestly. And then it comes off authentic. And he's a great dramatic actor suddenly.
Yeah.
Which, he is. He's perfectly good and very good in playing himself.
Yeah, so I was thinking also about how you've got drawn to a lot of roles that this kind of like almost like a used car salesman kind of guy.
Yeah.
He's a little bit rough around the edges, slightly untrustworthy.
You're
from like kind of small town Illinois, right?
Yeah.
And were you around those kind of characters at all? Like, is that partly where it's come from?
Well, yeah, my father. My dad was a funny guy.
Yeah.
He joked around a lot. you know, he was one of these salesmen who always had a bankroll in his pocket, but he had no money. He had no actual money. I mean, he had actual money, cash, but it was borrowed. So I think a bit of a person who worked the situation. He wasn't a used car salesman, but, you know, those people were around us. And certainly my dad and his friends were guys who were on some level scamming the world around them to get by. Yeah. Yeah. All of his friends ended up bankrupt. Every one of them.
Really?
Yeah. They all ended up divorced, bankrupt, fucked.
Damn. Do you spend much time back there or...
It's a nice area. Naperville, Illinois is the town I'm from. It's 35 miles southwest of Chicago, and it's on the train line into Chicago. So people live there who work in the city. But it's a small, it was a small town. It was 20,000 people when I was first moved there, and it's now 175,000 or 180. It's exploded with population. But yeah, I go back there. My mom lives there and my sister lives there.
Yeah.
So yeah, I go back. It's a great little town. It's just, it's kind of a frustrating place for a teenager to, you want to get out when you're 14
sure.
or 15. You want to scoot.
Go to the big city. Yeah.
Go somewhere exciting.
But you've now, I guess more so than, well, definitely more so than any Breaking Bad actors, you've spent a lot of time in Albuquerque.
I do. I spent about 4.5 months out of the year in Albuquerque, which is a mid-sized to smaller city in America.
Yeah, I visited
it. It was larger, but a lot of people have left. There's no factories there anymore. And I think the town, it made its bones as a way station on the highway on Route 66. Mm. That's why there were so many hotels in that town. If you drive down the main street, Central, there are still these beautiful neon signs for the old hotels that they've left the signs up, but they've taken the buildings down in many cases. The town was a very important stop over for people and trucks driving across the country. But of course, then they built the interstate highway in probably the 60s or maybe the late 50s. And once they built enough highway, you didn't need to stop anymore. You could just keep driving straight through. So that deprived the town of a lot of business. It's a town that's taken some pretty hard knocks. Like many mid-sized cities in America, it's had a rough time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you could see it, but maybe you could.
Yeah, driving around, you know, every other building would often be like
vacant
and no windows and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I see. It's an inherently quite cinematic place, isn't it? Like you say, with the signs and with the...
With the sky.
Mm, yeah.
I mean, the sky, there's this very strange experience of... it's almost like you can feel the Earth's curvature wherever you stand in Albuquerque, because the sky is so big and there's the mountains on one side, but you just can almost see the Earth curving around you.
It's like super high altitude, right?
It's 5,300 feet, and then it goes up to 7,300, I believe, up in the Sandia Mountains.
Does it make a difference filming out there in terms of how the production feels when you're away from, as opposed to somewhere like LA? Do you feel like you got your team out there making this little thing together?
Oh yeah,
it's not such a big kind of expectation and sort of. I mean, obviously it's still a huge production, but
I mean, sticking a crew out in the middle of nowhere like that is a very good thing for focusing everyone on the moments and the story as it's created. You really, everybody's got their head in the same story, you know, and that's very helpful. And then it's a very easy town to use. We have these awesome studios called Q Studios, these modern studios that are amazing. There's not a lot like them, even in Los Angeles. And as well, the town, which we shoot a lot of location in Albuquerque, the town is very cooperative and it's very easy to use relative to LA. Like you can take the whole circus, which is all the crew and all the trucks across town. We often do that twice in one day, and that's just impossible. That would be impossible in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So As a result, we get to do more location shooting, which is more of a filmic look. You're using the whole world, and you know, we can use restaurants and parks, and you know, the streets are very usable for us. You know, it's a great thing, and the city looks amazing. The lighting, I mean, because of the altitude, I think, and because of whatever, I mean, light is different in every city, you know. And the light there is kind of special and gives us this. I think Vince Gilligan, who created Breaking Bad, and Peter Gould, who joined him on creating Better Call Saul, Peter wrote the first episode that featured Saul Goodman in the Breaking Bad series. I think they both feel that it gives us a kind of a Western, like an old Western type vibe. And there are even scenes in Breaking Bad and even in Saul that are kind of shot as a... This happens more than once in the course of a season that are kind of feel like showdowns or like face-offs, old-time Western face-offs, you know? We shot a scene in season three. Man, it felt like we should have had pistols on our hips. You know, it was just two people across this desert... landscape facing off and then approaching each other and using words but gunning each other down.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah. Thinking about that, actually, and like I've spoken to Peter and Vince, who I think would be the first to admit this, that it's felt like they're trying to work out what the tone is for the show and trying to get the balance right between, is this a comedic thing? Is it a, like about like a small town courtroom drama? Is it a comedy? Is it a... And you said that in season three,
I think it's more dynamic than ever, which is to say there are sequences that are fairly much comic all the way through, for a few minutes at a time. And then there are incredibly dramatic scenes that have no comic edge to them at all, mixed in right next to each other. And then there are what I would call the gangster scenes that I'm not necessarily in so much, because the two worlds of Mike's world and Nacho's world and Saul's world are still parallel and just touching at points, and they're coming together.
Yeah.
But when you go to those scenes with the gangsters, I mean, that's a different vibe than the stuff with Saul, which you know, I find myself one day on Saul doing something that almost feels like Mr. Show, the sketch show I did in America. And then the next day playing a very intense, very heartfelt, dramatic moment, you know.
Yeah.
It's really wild and wonderful. I mean, when those things happen is when I really realize that that this role is really something I should, you know, that will probably never be repeated for me.
Yeah.
Because it's not really... Nobody gets a chance to do this.
Yeah, it's anywhere. Such a huge part of your life as well.
So. Yeah, but also just it doesn't exist anywhere else. I mean, even in other TV shows, they if they're drama, they're more purely drama. And if they're in, even in feature films, maybe you get to have one dramatic scene or two, and then the rest of the film is more comic, you know.
Yeah.
But to keep getting to go to these different places and to juxtapose that kind of performance throughout multiple episodes is just an incredible experience.
Yeah. I like that you said that we get to see Saul Goodman as if he's like a monster that comes down from the hills in season three.
He's a monster, but he doesn't come down from the hills. He comes out from inside like Alien. Yeah. He comes shooting out from the chest. Yes, but in season three, we get to see Saul Goodman, but not in the form that you ultimately see him in Breaking Bad. You see a version of Saul Goodman, and he is called Saul Goodman.
Nice.
It's a bit of a spoiler, but not really, because it's not what you expect. But it's fun. It's very much fun.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Cool, buddy.
Cool. Right. Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, both. Thanks
was that good? Was that good?
Great,
did I sound like an idiot?
No, you didn't sound
did
like an idiot.
Did I talk too much?
Cool. So that was episode 3 of Kernels. I hope you enjoyed it. Do please remember to subscribe to us on whatever podcast app you use, on iTunes. If you could leave us a review, that would really help us out. It boosted us up the charts last week, which has been fantastic. And I sincerely thank everyone for who made that happen. You can also keep in touch with what other guests we've got coming up and other stuff on our Twitter and Instagram accounts, which are just @Kernels for Twitter and @Kernels Podcast for Instagram. All right, thanks, and I'll see you in a couple of weeks.